there is a specific interest in providing assistance to special forces and internal security forces. Why is that?
My guess is, with the U.S. at least, is that there's a perception of these are the most capable forces, the most likely ones to engage with potential insurgents or infiltrators from Afghanistan or, you know, Taliban down the road. So, given that, you know, the bulk of military forces in the region are kind of Soviet legacy forces that aren't necessarily so capable, there was a decision made at some point to focus on the most capable.
In the conclusion part of your report, you do say that the governments are more concerned about the threats that come from within, not necessarily from outside.
Yeah, I have a bit of a critique of assisting special forces, and that comes from the just looking at how they've been used in actuality, as opposed to the theory of how they might be used in the future, which is, you know, these cases, not a lot of cases, but some serious ones, where they were used against protesters and
Andijan,
yeah. Clearly, you know, the hopes placed on them in Kyrgyzstan in 2010 didn't prove to be fulfilled. You mentioned Josh Kuchera; he's done some excellent reporting on Tajikistan, where some of their special forces were engaged in. To me, the history that we've seen over the last few years is of special forces being misused against the population. Oh, Kazakhstan, Jan Ozen is another example. So that's kind of where I see a potential problem. You know, the real threats are seen as internal, mm-hmm. despite whatever rhetoric is put out about mm-hmm. external threats. And that also leads to what I think would be a beneficial change, which is to actually work, not to provide money, because they don't need necessarily money, but to provide training. So one thing that a lot of the U.S. and EU and other Western countries have a lot of experience with training police, for example, on how to deal with crowds, how to deal with protesters, without excessive force, right? Without using extreme violence. And I don't think, you know, Central Asian, from everything I've seen, Central Asian interior ministry type forces, that's not something they're practicing on their own. So, to the extent that it's a complicated situation, because you don't want to be teaching interior ministry forces how to put down protesters, right? But at the same time, you do want to try to prevent loss of life, right? So there's some range of, you know, Central Asian countries are very different from each other, and so assistance that might be quite beneficial in Kyrgyzstan, for example, or even Tajikistan, you may not want to do that if you're the U.S. government. You may not want to do that in Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that's the kind of thing that I think might be more helpful for promoting internal stability than some of the other things.
You also say that the Central Asian states have always manipulated the threat perception, mm-hmm. you know, to strengthen their own power, mm-hmm. especially Central Asian leaders. Can you briefly explain that?
Yeah, well, there is, this is, a lot of this is derived from Alex Cooley's work, you're probably familiar with, where the local rulers are trying to use this international attention that they've had for the last decade or so to achieve some of their own goals. So they understand very well what sort of engages American policymakers, Russian policymakers, European policymakers, and use that rhetoric to get additional resources that then they use to some extent for those foreign ends, but also for their own ends, along the lines that we were just talking about in terms of maintaining internal stability and so forth.
But has there been any positive impact that you have seen, any evidence of positive impact so far?
Well, it goes part way, I guess. So, for example, one big area of assistance, especially from the European Union, has been in border security and trying to reduce drug smuggling. And the U.S. has also provided under through programs for weapons of mass destruction, so preventing radioactive elements and stuff like that from being smuggled. And that, having that technology there on the borders is a positive, right? The problem is when, that's seen as the entirety of the policy, and there isn't as much recognition of the role that, say, corruption, for example, plays, so that you can have the best technology in the world, but if the scanner is turned off when the appropriately paid off shipment is coming through, it's not going to do any good. So I don't want to say that it doesn't do any good. It's just that it has to be.
And you have to tackle the problem of corruption.
Yeah, and U.S. government officials fully understand this. The problem is that's a much more difficult problem to tackle, especially if that corruption goes to higher levels in government, and there's no desire to deal with it except on a very kind of pro forma level. So it's not. This is not, I by no means am I casting aspersions on U.S. government policy in this regard. It's just a very difficult problem, and you can do the easy part, but that doesn't mean you're going to solve it unless the local governments want to.
Who has the strongest military in Central Asia now? Which country?
I would say Kazakhstan. They've really sort of focused on modernizing their equipment, tried to reform some of their training methods. So there really is more of a focus there, whereas Uzbekistan, for example, which is the other country, there's three countries that have money, right? Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan is kind of strange and insular and isn't really doing much beyond kind of show, it's the parade, showy parade school
show off,
of military reform. Uzbekistan, as we discussed, is primarily focused on internal security.